We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
The following is a special edition of the Dave Sinclair Lincoln and Ford Sports Open Line.
Welcome to Sports and More with Mike Claiborne. Sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bonaire on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Well, first of all, Dan Dierdorf, it's great to see you. It's been a while.
Michael, it is great to see you. We haven't broken bread in a while or caught up, so
I'm
this
glad
is
we're
fun.
Doing.
I'm
this,
looking,
I'm
forward,
looking
to.
Forward to it also. Well, let's talk about when you were a kid. Now, you're from Canton, the home of the Hall of Fame. Football is all they do. What kind of football player were you at the early stage, and when did you know, okay, you know, I've got a chance to be special here, or at least have a chance to go to college?
Well, I was bigger than everybody else. I was one of those. I was always the largest kid in my class, and always the biggest guy on my team. But I was not. I didn't get a letter when I was a sophomore in high school. I got a letter my junior and senior year. I was all county, that kind of stuff, but I wasn't all state. When I was a senior in high school, I wasn't. I was hardly what you would call a blue chip recruit.
So you were Jim Parker at it.
I was not Jim Parker. Ohio State didn't offer me a scholarship. Michigan State didn't offer me a scholarship. I only had two Big Ten offers. One was from Indiana. John Pont was the coach over in Indiana. And the other offer I had came in very late, and it was from the University of Michigan.
Bump Elliott was there.
Elliott was the coach there. Mm-hmm. But the coach who recruited me was the defensive backfield coach, Don James, who ended up being the coach at Washington and, mm-hmm. and one of the better college coaches ever. He's from Massillon, Ohio, which is right next door to Canton. And he played high school football and grew up with my high school coach.
So you had that connection.
And that's where the connection came from. And I have always believed that somebody in their recruiting class backed out because they didn't offer me till like February of my senior year. And I took a trip up there. I loved it. And I signed.
So the state of Ohio didn't seal the border to keep you in the state at that time.
Oh, no, they didn't. And, you know, people always got mad at me. There's always a stigma in Ohio. If you're born mm-hmm. and raised there and you go to Michigan, they're always mad at you. And I had a get-out-of-jail-free card. I said, hey, Woody didn't offer me a scholarship. And I met Woody a couple times later on when I was playing for the Cardinals, and he was very gracious about it. He said, hey, I blew it. It was my mistake.
Yeah, well, you know, he's not going to get everybody. So with that said, you go to Michigan. Were you a good student back then? I mean, were you a guy that was able to adapt well?
Yeah, I adapted to college life. It wasn't until my freshman year at Michigan that I would say, yeah, that was the first time that it really dawned on me that maybe I could be a good college player. Mm-hmm. Back then, freshmen weren't eligible to play varsity football. That didn't happen until a couple years later. And so the way my life turned was that both of our defensive tackles were returning, and one of the offensive tackles had graduated. So they put me at offensive tackle.
And now, playing tackle, you had a few injuries along the way as well, and that may have maybe slowed down the progress a little bit.
Well, you know, I started every game in college. I had a knee injury my junior year. I got hurt in the Ohio State game. I got hurt on the first play of the game. Went out to block a linebacker, and I planted my leg and cut and tore my MCL.
This is pre-AstroTurf.
This was on the grass field at Columbus.
Because you remember, as you well know, AstroTurf then was very primitive.
That's what we had in Ann Arbor. We had something that was actually worse than AstroTurf. It was called Tartan Turf.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
3M made it. Oh, baby, was that stuff. It was like playing on steel wool.
As one guy said, it's like playing on concrete before they smooth it over.
Well, that's Busch Stadium. That's what it was at. Busch Stadium, I've always said, is like playing on concrete with a piece of indoor-outdoor carpeting rolled over the top of it.
Brutal time to be playing.
But, yeah, I started every game at Michigan, and it was probably after my sophomore year where I really thought, well, you know what, maybe I can make something of myself.
So before the NFL was like this mega event as far as a draft is concerned on TV, how did you find out that you, A, were drafted, B, the team you were playing for, you were going to be playing for, and what did you know about St. Louis as a whole?
Well, the only thing I knew about St. Louis as a whole, I'll start with that, is that I grew up a Cleveland Browns fan. And the Browns used to play the Cardinals all the time. And the Cardinals always gave my Brownies a tough go. The Cardinals had this sawed off little cornerback,
Pat Fisher. Oh yeah,
and he used to go up against Gary Collins, the wide receiver for the Browns, and I used to get so mad. I'm going, how can he get covered by that little fart? and so that was basically the extent of my knowledge about the Cardinals. But you brought up the draft. Yes, it was a little different.
Was it a phone call, back telegram,
then, back then, rumor? The draft was at the end of January. So the draft was really early compared to how it is now. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it was strictly a phone call. I thought I was going to get drafted in the first round, so I was upset. I left. I went for a walk, and while I was gone, I think George Boone called.
Boone. Well, yeah. I won't call him the great George Boone. No, let's call him George Boone.
Yeah, George Boone called, who was the director of player personnel, I guess, for the Cardinals back then. So I got drafted by a team that didn't even have a coach. It should have been a precursor. They had
Charlie Winter.
They fired Charlie Winter, and they had not yet hired Bob Holloway. So I got drafted by a team that didn't have a coach. The red flag should have gone off. I should have realized right then that this was going to be an unconventional trip.
Well, Bob Holloway, you're right. He defensive coordinator with the Vikings.
Yes.
And they brought him in, and he was apparently a very good defensive coach, but apparently his people skills didn't follow his defensive ability.
Wow. I don't know what I could say to
to counter
add
that.
To that. That's a very good description.
I was being nice about
Bob, you know, Bob was a good guy, but he tried to be Bud Grant. You know, instead of being himself, he tried to emulate Bud Grant and the way Bud ran the system in Minnesota, and it just didn't work. He was hard on us. I thought playing for Bo Schembechler was tough, but
until you ran into
Bob Holloway, he wouldn't let us have a drink during practice. I mean just crazy stuff.
Now it's funny you talk about guys who come from one place. Now he comes from a place that had Bob Lertzema, Carl Eller, Alan Page. Gary Larson. That's pretty good front four. He didn't have anything like that, and he didn't have Fran Tarkenton, and he didn't have a lot of good players the Vikings had. So then you find out whether he can really coach or not.
Well, yes, and you know, he certainly didn't inherit the defense that he had in Minnesota. We had offensive talent. I mean, Jim Hart was here. Jackie Smith was here. MacArthur Lane was here.
Oh, yeah, number 36.
Ernie McMillan. We had some talent here.
Any truth to that rumor that the year MacArthur Lane rushed for 936 yards, he would have had a bonus had he got to 1,000 yards, and for some reason he didn't get a chance to play?
Well, I think that was the year before I got here, so I didn't see that firsthand. I know that the relationship between Mac and the Bidwell family was strained.
We're being nice here, aren't we, about some of these terms?
At times it was very strained. And MacArthur pretty much facilitated his trade to Green Bay when towards the end of the season, Bill Bidwell walked through the locker room and MacArthur unleashed a real string of obscenities. And that's one way to guarantee that you're not going to be here at the start of next year. Yeah.
Dan Dierdorf is our guest. Stick around. We're coming back with more.
This is a special edition of the Dave Sinclair Lincoln and Ford Sports Open Line.
Welcome back to Sports and More, sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bonaire. Once again, Mike Claiborne on KMOX.
Dan Dierdorf is our guest as we continue here with Sports and More.
All right, now you come back, and Bob Hallway is a short-timer. He's just there for
2 years.
2 years and maybe 1 year too long. So here comes a guy named Don Coryell. Who was from the West Coast, and everybody liked Don Coryell, and everybody thought he deserved a chance, so he gets a chance. But he brings along another guy with him, and this is maybe where your career started to go in another direction, a guy who led the country in receiving as an end, and now he's a line coach. Talk about that relationship with Coryell, saving the offense and basically saving Jim Hart's career, and then here comes Jim Hanifin.
Well, you got to understand something. This was pre-ESPN. This was pre-300 channels. There wasn't a guy on our team that I knew that had any idea who Don Coryell was. Mm-hmm. He was the coach at San Diego State. He might as well have been coaching in Honolulu or Japan. Back then, California, we didn't know anything.
Right.
We didn't know anything. And so he shows up, and he's now the head coach of the Cardinals. And he has, back then, coaching staffs were much smaller compared. You know, you see it now where teams have 19, 20, 21 coaches.
Yeah.
Well, back then, Don Coryell had three offensive coaches. The wide receiver quarterback coach was Rod Dahauer. The line coach was Jim Hanifin. And the running backs coach was Joe Gibbs. And For 5 years, that staff remained intact. And by the way, before you ask me a question, I will say, if you would have pulled any of the players, we would have, I guarantee you that we would have collectively said, the guy with the least chance to be a successful head coach would be Joe Gibbs. Just because Joe's personality,
he was the quietest
of the group and all this. It's a good thing Joe wasn't a racehorse because I'd have lost.
He'd have been at the glue factory a lot sooner.
But how about that for a collection of talent?
Incredible. And when you talk about those guys, do you think at that point, because there wasn't as much information available, I mean, you can dial up anything anytime, these were guys who really had to coach people up.
Oh yeah.
And that's a great difference compared to what you have now.
Well, Joe Gibbs coached 1,000 yards out of Jim Otis. If that didn't indicate that he had Hall of Fame potential, what
that did? Got him in with nothing else. So I'm sure in that committee room, they're like, okay, why is Gibbs here? Why is his name on the list? Hey, he coached up Jim Otis for
1,036 yards in, for Jim Otis.
Yeah, unanimous at that
3.9 yards at a time.
Well, he didn't have a rush over 25 yards that year.
He broke. We have one classic piece of footage. Jim Otis breaks into the open. He's got like 60 yards of open space in front of him, and there's a shot where he turns and looks for Steve Jones because he wanted to lateral the ball. And you know, we only laugh about Jim Otis because I'll tell you something.
Tough hombre.
Oh God, he was tough, and he never lost yardage. That's the thing that you appreciated about Jim Otis. He never bounced it to the outside. We used to call him the king of cutback because Jim Otis, it was going between the tackles. And you know what? I appreciated that
I'm sure from him. Did. Yeah. You know, when you talk about Jim Otis and that and blocking for him, let's talk about that offensive line. They marked you guys down for 8 sacks given up, but actually it was 7 because one was on a punt.
It actually was 6. But
okay, break it down. Tell me about it.
Well, it was the one they got Jim Bakken got caught behind the line of scrimmage on a fake field goal, and they ruled that was an attempted pass, What a crock. So that was one of them. The other one was, we are mopping up against the New York Jets at Shea Stadium. I mean, we're beating. And they take Hart out of the game, and they put our backup quarterback in, a guy named Gary Quazo. Gary Keithley. Quazo was here earlier.
Keithley was also the punter, too.
Yeah. They put him in to mop up. He audibles to a pass and gets sacked. So we are standing at the 50-yard line of Shea Stadium back then, and I am restraining Dobler because Conrad is going to beat him to a pulp. Now, this might have been great footage. I should have let him go.
Yeah, that would have
because
been.
It's not every day you see an offensive guard beating the holy crap out of your own quarterback at the 50-yard line. But he had it coming.
Speaking of beating
the crap.
So we had,
legitimately, we gave up 6 sacks. And I'll tell you the one thing we did, which was really amazing. This was a 14-game season back then. At the end of 7 games, halfway through the season, we'd given up 0.
Somebody got sloppy in the second half.
We went 7 consecutive games.
Unheard of.
Without a sack.
And I know some will
say.
And
it started to weigh on Jim Hart. It started to weigh on everybody a little bit.
But one of the things about Hart, he had that quick release.
Yeah,
he could cut it loose with anyone.
Yeah. Well, you knew where he was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't Fran Tarkenton.
It's not going to be hard.
No, and people go, well, geez, isn't that make it? No, it makes an offensive lineman, it makes your job easier when you know where your guy is. There's nothing worse than running your guy upfield knowing full well you're taking him out
right.
the perimeter of the pocket, and then the two of you run over your quarterback because he's on some mad scramble. So, yeah, it was but we were very proud of that we were that good pass blocking.
Speaking of which, you said physically assault. Offensive line play then compared to what we see now, there were assaults taking place on the field.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows the story about Conrad Dobler, but the way Jim Hanifin taught how to block, basically, if it was done anywhere else, somebody would be arrested.
Well, Jim Hanifin, one of the first times we were in a meeting with him, he told us, he said, I want somebody to go get the book where it says defensive linemen are meaner and nastier and tougher than offensive linemen. I need somebody to show me where that's doctrine, where that is the way it's supposed to be. He said, let me tell you something. I don't believe in that. And he told us that we are going to be the nasty, physical, dominant group on the field, not the defensive line, which is the way I think everybody's coming up. You know, the defensive guys are the tough guys.
Right.
And he didn't want to hear about that. And so, and back then, we weren't allowed, you know, the rules for offensive linemen were kind of archaic. Compared to today, I mean, we weren't even allowed to have our hands open.
Yeah.
We couldn't hit somebody with an open palm because that was against the rules. You know, there's a picture all the time where I got my fist clenched. Well, that's how we had to block.
Well, think about it. Remember the old promotional photographs of football card guys that had their fists together?
Well, that's exactly
that's
right.
That's how you had to block.
You're right in front of your sternum. Mm-hmm. Well, thank God I came along a little after that. If you notice, most of these pictures are in color, too. You know?
That's a good point. Hey, you got a face mask on, too. That's a good thing to have going
aren't
for you.
You always got to go a step farther, don't you? But you're right. So Hanifin said, well, wait a minute. If we have to play with a closed fist, well, let's use it. And because you could, and we did, you could haul off and punch a guy as hard as you could. If you could keep yourself under control at the same time, don't overextend, lose your balance. But there are a lot of times when a guy came in to any of us, and if he was foolish enough to put his arms up in the air, we were going to tickle his liver because we were drilling him right in the gut. And you know what? Those arms, they started to come down.
Dead deer orphans, I guess. Stick around. We're coming back with more.
This is a special edition of the Dave Sinclair, Lincoln and Ford Sports Open Line.
Welcome back to Sports and More, sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bonaire. Once again, Mike Claiborne on KMOX.
Dan Dierdorf is our guest as we continue here with Sports and More.
You end your career, but you already had another career going. Say hello to Bob Hyland.
Yes. I played from 71 to 83. I started to work at Camo X in 76. Jim Bakken and Jim Hart used to do a show on a Saturday afternoon called The Arm and the Leg. And Bakken went on a three-week vacation, and they asked me if I'd sit in. And I don't have any words of magic or anything. I don't know why. The red light came on, and I started to talk, and it just seemed so natural. I think broadcasting vexes a lot of people. They don't understand. They think it's harder. And I think those of us that have done it over the years and had some modicum of success, if we're really being honest, we would say, you know, it just really comes remarkably easy to us. And that's the way it was. And so I had this unbelievable background working for Bob Hyland, for Jack Buck, who was our sports director, and I had the luxury of cutting my teeth in another profession while I was still playing football. So I knew what I was going. When I got hurt in 79, in April, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to play. And I went into Mr. Hyland's office, and he said, Dan, he said, here's the deal. You play as long as you can play, but you don't worry about what you're going to do when you can't play anymore. We'll just move your locker from Busch Stadium to Camo X.
Now, did you have to go in at 3 in the morning to talk to him like everybody else, or did you have regular business hours to go see?
I actually got in there during regular business hours because I wasn't asking for a raise.
That's a good way to do it.
If I was asking for a raise, I would have been relegated to the 3 a.m. shift. Costas.
Exactly. We were all standing in line and wait for the next guy to come out. How much?
He gave me a luxury.
Yeah.
He gave me a gift that I was never able to repay. And then when I decided to retire, and I announced my retirement halfway through the 83 season, I actually went in and told Mr. Hyland first before I went over and told Mr. Biddle. I wanted him to know first.
No one will ever be like Bob Hyland.
He was an amazing man. I look back at the times I was sitting around in the sports office at Camo X with Bill Wilkerson and Bob Starr and Dan Kelly and Jack and Costas, and I'm sitting there and you know, Shannon had strolled through, and I'm just sitting there going, are you kidding me? They're not making me write a check just to sit here in the company of these people. It was, and you know, and then again, you know, the morning show was Bob Hardy and Rex Davis, and Ann Keefe was in the afternoon, and Jim White was at night. And if you're of a certain age listening to this, if you're not a little nostalgic at some of those names, well, then I don't care.
You talk about Camo X and you talk about that experience. You did a lot of things at Camo X. You just weren't the morning guy, the sports open line guy. You were one of the great analysts for one of the few wrestling events Camo X had with you and the late, great Ann Keefe and Bob Costas.
I'm telling you, it was Hulk Hogan against Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, who was managed by Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Oh, yeah.
And we, Costas and I, end up at White Castle at like 2 o'clock in the morning with Bobby the Brain Heenan and Orndorff, and we get a bag of White Castles and we take them over to Jim White. And we're sitting in the studio with White eating White Castles, and yeah, Don't ask me how that came about.
That's all right.
Would ever imagine that Bob Hyland would go for that?
Yeah, not only the fact that
we're in tuxedos. Ann Keefe is in a ball gown.
This is a huge event in St. Louis.
Oh, the old arena was sold out. I mean, it was a big deal.
But you had fun with everything you did. You transitioned to local TV. You were on TV for a while as well at Channel 4 doing the sports. How much fun was that?
It was all in the same building.
Right.
So I would do, I was doing afternoon drive for CAMOX, and then I'd do sports open line, and I would only do the 10 o'clock news on Channel 4. And what I remember most about that was when I would wrap up sports open line, say there was a baseball game or something, I would go to dinner with Steve Schiff and Julius Hunter.
What a combination.
Yes. And two guys that were in tremendous fear of dehydration.
Being well saturated was something that they really strived
to be. Dinner, we'd go down to Laclede's Landing. And, yes. God, those were some great times.
Speaking of dinner, one of my favorite lines of any local commercial, I'm thinking of a steak.
I have sold a lot of red meat in this town. Jimmy and I, in an era where, you know, the average life of a restaurant is measured in months, we had a 31-year run with Deardorff and Arts, and we had an orderly sayonara in the sense that, our lease was expiring. My partner, who was a manager, wanted to retire, and so we just...
Just a nice way to walk away from it.
Yeah, we just said, it's time to go.
And, you make a great point about restaurants. I mean, Stan Musial had one, Mike Shannon, you and Jim Hart, Ozzy.
I predated Shannon. I predated Ozzy.
Yeah, I mean...
I didn't predate Musial and Biggie.
No, he was give Stan there and credit. Gone.
Stan was first.
But he started it. But you came along, and I thought that you were really... the gold standard for restaurants and what we would term a high-end restaurant where athletes and people would want to go eat after an event. And you were able to get that thing started. And I think the way, as you mentioned, the way you ended it is probably the way a lot of people would compare to having bill collectors or whatever or a bad reputation and ended on a positive note.
Well, I thought so. And thanks for the compliment. But your times were different back then. I've got pictures from when we opened in 1983. 98% of the men sitting there eating were wearing coat and tie.
That's right.
People,
the onion loaf bread. Man.
I owned the restaurant during the great transition from more formal to casual.
Union Station. It was really one of the high water marks for Union Station to be housed there because Union Station was making a comeback, and you decided to go in there.
I was the first tenant.
Yeah, really.
I signed the first lease. To go in Union Station.
That's it.
That's why I took that space up front, because I wanted to have my own door onto Market Street in case the whole thing didn't make it. I could
we'll
at least
still be here.
I could at least say our address was 1820 Market Street. Come on in.
Dan Deardorff is our guest. Stick around. We're coming back with more.
This is a special edition of the Dave Sinclair Lincoln and Ford Sports Open Line.
Welcome back to Sports and More, sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bonaire. Once again, Mike Claiborne on KMOX.
Dan Deardorff is our guest as we continue here with Sports and More.
So now you have the restaurant going, you're having success with TV and radio. All of a sudden, the network calls. Here you go. You're going to CBS. How difficult of a decision was that, considering you had everything? And were you in a position where you felt you needed a new challenge?
Well, I think everybody wants to do television. It's the natural progression. If you like talking about football, talking about it on television, I felt confident in doing that because when I retired. Okay. All right. The very first thing that happened to me was I'm going to retire at the end of the 83 season. So the 83 season ends. Jack Buck, he put in a word for me. There's divisional playoff weekend. There are four games, two on Saturday, two on Sunday. It's the only time that Jack and Hank couldn't do the game. So they needed another broadcast crew. Jack Buck talked CBS radio. The first football game I ever broadcast was to the entire country on CBS radio network, two divisional playoff games for CBS radio. And I'd never been in a broadcast booth before, and Jack Buck talked CBS into hiring me to do that.
Basically, he saw something that no one else saw at the time.
Yes. I can you imagine that? I mean,
it won't happen today.
No. And so then the next year, NBC talked to me about, they offered me like six games. I passed because I had the opportunity to do the football Cardinals on radio on Camo X with Jack Buck as my partner. So in 1984, I did 40 radio football games in the fall of 1984. John Rooney and I did Missouri football. Mm-hmm. Jack and I did Cardinal football, and I did about eight games or so for six or eight games for CBS radio. I did games with who are some of the guys I did with? Frank Lieber, Ray Scott,
one of the best.
Lindsey Nelson. I did
Vern Lundquist, was he part of that?
I didn't do one with Vern until a little bit later.
I'll find it later. What was the game where everything went haywire at the end and you were just so excited and then all of you said, oh, wait, by the way, I'm fine. You remember that game?
Yeah. The Cardinals were beating somebody, and Neil O'Donoghue had to make a field goal, which back then
was a hit and miss.
It was like Dave Kingman catching a fly ball. It was hit or miss. And so you're right. I threatened to jump out of the booth. I did.
You had a lot of fun then.
Oh, yeah. Well, can you imagine? Can you imagine working with Jack? And
yeah.
Because not only was it fun, but he was such a, he just taught me so many things about things like cataloging your adjectives. We went to a commercial break one time. He said, since the last commercial break, you used the word fantastic three times. He said, Dan, when you use an adjective, recycle it. Put it in the back of the line and don't try to go and because when you're at home, it can start to, the listener picks up on that and it's like drilling a hole in their head. And just little things like that that I've never forgotten. What a gift that I had being able to be mentored by Jack.
Were we all?
I mean, really?
The best.
Oh, just unbelievable.
All right, so here comes Monday Night Football. Now, this is the crown jewel of broadcasting sports, period.
Yes.
This is the only job everybody ever would ever want. You get the call.
I got to do Monday Night Football when it was Monday Night Football.
Absolutely.
It was
must watch.
It was the number one show on television. Yep. It was still.
And who were your partners?
Well, I did it for 12 years. For the first 11, I did it with Frank and Al. And then the last year, ESPN took over and decided they were going to phase us all out. So they got Frank first. So my last year, I worked with Al and Boomer Esiason. And then my contract expired and they got me.
But you
went Steve back. Bornstein took over.
But you went home. You went back to CBS.
I went back to CBS.
Yeah. And that was fun.
Yes. Oh, no, I went back to CBS for 15 more years. So
yeah,
30 years I did network television.
And that's saying a lot because we don't see people survive that long for one reason or another. What do you think the key was, aside from you being prepared and understanding what was needed of you?
Well, the key for me was is that I didn't get thrown into the deep end of the pool without already having learned how to swim.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew, I took pride in the fact that I thought I was a professional broadcaster. I knew the ins and outs of the business. I wasn't just an ex-jock. I got hired because I could talk. I wasn't a Hall of Fame quarterback. I was not a marquee guy in that regard. And so I always thought that I got the job because I knew how to do it.
And having said that, you're in the Pro Football Hall of Fame for two occasions. Everybody knows about you being a player, but also a Roselle Award winner, one of three. It's you, Gifford, and Pat Summerall, who formerly played.
No, you got two out of the three. Pat's not in the Hall of Fame as a player. The third is John Madden.
Madden played?
No, but he's in as a coach. John's in the
Good
Pro Football Hall.
Good point.
Yeah.
All right.
He's the only guy that has a Madden and myself and since Lenny Dawson, I believe, got the Roselle Award in the last couple of years. But yeah, we're the only ones that have a bust and actually got the Roselle Award as well.
This game has been great to you in every sense of the word, but you paid a price for it as well. How many surgeries for you? How many times have you been under the knife and because of what you did for a living?
I don't think I've ever actually counted them all up.
But really? It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. Orthopedically, I'm as healthy as a horse, but orthopedically, I've been destroyed. And it's really interesting, Mike, I'll tell you, and I really, truly mean this. I don't blame the game of football. To me, it wasn't football that did this to me. It was AstroTurf. It was AstroTurf. The fact that not only did I play the games on it, but for every game, there were probably 10 or 12 practices.
Well, when you were
and
at Busch
every
Stadium,
practice
yeah.
was on that stuff. And even training camp, they built an AstroTurf field for us to have two-a-days. And we didn't know it at the time, but we were all getting ground to dust. Our spinal columns were disintegrating. Our hips and our knees were... And so, yeah, I have more titanium in me than my golf bag. What are you going to do? But I don't blame the game of football.
And you know, I don't know if they've ever done a survey or a study of the people who played in your era who all suffer from the same thing. If it's not a knee replacement, it's a hip replacement. If it's not a hip, it's an ankle. There's so many right. things from the lower extremities. Neck and back surgeries now have come into play. And it's unfortunate because that was a great era of football.
It was a wonderful era of football. But it was kind of like the Wild Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, during the course of the game, you could hit anybody anywhere as long as the whistle hadn't blown. You could clean a guy's clock 40 yards from the football, and it didn't make any difference. As long as the whistle hadn't blown, it was legal. But the thing of it is that where they've changed for the better now is the guys don't practice the way we used to practice. I wore full pads every practice for my entire career, college and pro. Yeah, they don't practice like that anymore.
They even have a rule now.
Oh, they even have
in training yeah. camp. You can't
drives
wear
the coaches yeah. crazy. The 2-a-days are gone. You
yeah,
don't
forget it.
2-a-days. We had coaches that had 3-a-days.
What about yeah? Were
we
you
used
in
to
college?
Kill ourselves.
Were you in college? Did you have 3-a-days?
No,
you had one in the morning, one before lunch, and
we'd
one in the
scrimmage after. Every yeah. day. Every day was live. I mean, yeah. we used to, you know, that's the biggest, it was, but, you know, I played, we had AstroTurf practice fields at Michigan. If I would have been drafted by a team that had a grass field and a grass practice facility, I wouldn't look the way I look today.
Thank you, sir.
All right,
always
Michael.
Good to see you.
All right, thank you, pal.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!